Hey, folks, I am super excited for another live ACRAC podcast from ASA in San Antonio this year. On Saturday, October 11th at 4 p.m. San Antonio time, we will be having a live episode from the exhibit floor on center stage. It's going to be fabulous. I will be interviewing Dr. Joyce Warr, who's a cardiac anesthesiologist who transitioned into perioperative anesthesia and patient safety, first in the cardiac operating rooms and then throughout all the ORs. And she wrote a fabulous paper that was deemed one of the best papers of the decade called An AHA Scientific Statement on Patient Safety in the Cardiac Operating Rooms. She's going to talk about cognitive basis for human error, and we're going to have a conversation about what that means and how we can try to prevent all of us from making unintended errors that can hurt patients. So we're going to talk about improving patient safety. It's going to be a fabulous conversation, and I hope you can join us in San Antonio live from the exhibit floor on center stage on Saturday, October 11th at 4 p.m. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm really excited for a great show today. Many of you have probably listened to the podcast, The Retrievals. The first season was about the pain that people were having during their REI procedures. And the second season, which just recently came out, is about pain during cesarean section. And when I heard it, I thought, wait a minute, we've talked about this on ACRAC, and it would be great to revisit in light of these stories. And of course, there's been new and upcoming research and more information that has been learned about this. It's such an important topic. And so I thought, let's have Dr. Hoffkamp and Dr. Sharp back on the show to discuss. So listeners will know they've both been on ACRAC before. Dr. Mike Hoffkamp is an associate professor of anesthesiology and obstetrics and gynecology at Baylor College of Medicine, Temple. He's also the director of obstetric anesthesia at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center, Temple. And Dr. Emily Sharp is an associate professor of anesthesiology at the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, and the obstetric anesthesia fellowship program director. She recently gave the Ostheimer Lecture at the 2025 Society for Obstetric Anesthesia and Perinatology annual meeting, which is an invited lecture that covers the obstetric and obstetric anesthesia literature for the preceding year. So both obviously super qualified to talk about this, and I'm excited to cover it with them. Mike and Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for the invitation.
So let's start by just talk a little bit about how you got interested in this topic. I know you both have been interested in this from before the retrievals happened, so it wasn't the podcast that got you into it, but was it just from practicing as an OB anesthesiologist, or, you know, did you have some specific instance or something that made you think, you know, we got to think hard about what we're doing here? Mike, do you want to start?
Sure. So in my experience as a resident and as a young attending, I noticed that we had this really ambivalence towards starting general anesthesia for pregnant patients during cesarean delivery. We would let them go through tremendous suffering, and many times general anesthesia would never be initiated. And the stated purpose of this practice was to avoid morbidity, mortality. And I think we were kind of siloed in that, you know, there was very little upside personally for the anesthesiologist to initiate general anesthesia, and lots of downside and risk and liability. And we really kind of glossed over the patient experience. And that those observations led me to want to investigate this further.
How about you, Emily?
Yeah, I actually, as a when I was trying to work on our department's center of excellence, one of the requirements was that our general anesthesia rate be less than 5%. And so I was paying really close attention to the general anesthetics that we were doing in our department and noticing, you know, like, how can we reduce our general anesthesia rate? What can we be doing to meet this metric? And as I reviewed every single case, I didn't feel like we were doing a lot of inappropriate general anesthetics. And I realized that to kind of meet this metric, we may have to not be treating our patients with pain. And so I actually got interested because I was trying to, I was trying to get rid of general anesthesia. But then I realized how actually we're probably doing the right thing. And so I fortunately worked somewhere where we didn't kind of force women to continue through these situations. But I kind of got interested in it, I feel like almost the backwards way, in that I was trying to reduce general anesthesia and then realizing, I don't want to do that. We should really be actually doing general anesthesia when it's appropriate for our patients having pain. And then, of course, I've had some really interesting kind of cases that have also really brought the story home to me in dealing with patients who have had pain and talking with them about that situation. So.
Yeah, well, that's really compelling. And so let's start there. You know, it definitely feels like we've gotten to a point where people will avoid, and by people, I mean we, right, anesthesiologists will avoid using general anesthesia for C-sections almost no matter what. And why is that? How did we get here? You mentioned one thing, Emily, that there's actual guidelines that require you to be below a certain percentage in order to meet a certain metrics. Talk about that and anything else that has led us to where we are in this sense.
So I think that when you look at where we're at, I think you have to look at the history of this topic, and it starts in the late 90s. A very distinguished and accomplished anesthesiologist by the name of Joy Hawkins. She published a paper in 1997, and she looked at closed claims data from the 1980s, and she reported the case fatality ratio for general anesthesia compared to regional anesthesia was about 17-fold. And so every time you put a patient to sleep for a cesarean delivery, it was believed that you were increasing that patient's risk of mortality by 17 times. And so people took notice of this, and there was soon a race to the bottom. We were trying to get that general anesthesia rate down to as low as it could go. And so there was a study published in 2011 that retrospectively looked at data from 2000 to 2005 at Brigham Hospital. And what it found was, or what reported, was a general anesthesia rate for cesarean delivery of less than 1%. And this is a strikingly low rate because it takes into account all comers, both failure of regional anesthesia, maternal comorbidities like thrombocytopenia and intracranial pathology, and emergency cesarean deliveries. It's just amazing that they had this low of a general anesthesia rate. What's missing from this study is how they got there. What kind of adjuvant agents did they use? Did they use, how much propofol did they use? How much ketamine did they use? And so the picture is a little bit incomplete, but clearly this hospital, Brigham, was responding to incentives by having a low rate. And to touch on Dr. Sharp's experience with the SOAP Center of Excellence, they want a general anesthesia rate of less than 5% as a marker of quality. And they have realized that there are institutions that are going to have a higher general anesthesia rate. So you can have a higher than 5% general anesthesia rate, but you have to show that you're continually auditing your general anesthetics. And I think it's a great example that Dr. Sharp said that she was in the process of auditing all her general anesthetics and said, you know, most of these are completely appropriate, even though we have a rate higher than 5%. And what happened is that there was other studies that reported liability. There was a good study published in 2009 in anesthesia and about the NHS in England from cases that were done from 1997 to 2007. They had about 1,100 claims. And 50 of these claims were related to OB anesthesia, particularly inadequate regional anesthesia. So this was starting to be recognized as a problem in the 2000s.
Yeah, and it is clearly, there's a lot of fear around this, right? People are worried about litigation. I mean, the difficult airway aspect of this is huge. That this came up in the retrievals, right? That people they think, look, the airway is going to be super difficult, and if I try and fail, then I'm toast, right? The patient's going to die, and pain is better than death, and right, all of these things are on people's minds. Emily, anything to add to kind of how we got where we are?
Well, I mean, I agree with you that is, you know, the fear of the obstetric airway, is a legitimate concern. We probably all can think of a really bad OB airway that we've been involved in that really is some of the scariest moments that I've had to deal with as an anesthesiologist. But fortunately, in 2025, we have a lot of different airway adjuncts that we can utilize to make this safer. And so I think that, you know, we're not in the same situation that we were in the 80s and 90s. And I don't think that we should continue to practice in the way that we did back then.
Yeah, that's a great point, right? So when Joy published her paper, that was at a time when certainly VL was not ubiquitous. And that's a huge difference. I mean, there's a lot of things that have changed. And so we really want to think about that. Now, what's interesting is there's the reality, which is that probably it's not as dangerous as we maybe once thought to convert to GA. And then there's the fear of litigation, right? So how do we address the fact that people are afraid they're going to get sued if they try it and it doesn't go well? Because they're going to be told you weren't supposed to do this. You tried to intubate a pregnant woman, and that's dangerous.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to change that conversation. And there has been data showing safety and showing that we can utilize video laryngoscopes. And when we talk about litigation, it really should be based off of our standard practice. And so when you are approaching the obstetric airway, are you following the difficult airway algorithm? Are you using your airway adjuncts such as video laryngoscopes? Are you using an LMA or supraglottic airway as a backup device? And so I think that's what we need to think about going forward. And just as Mike had said, you're going to have actually a whole lot more problems with litigation with a patient who has inadequately controlled pain than with a lost airway. But you need to need to understand what your resources are. So, you know, in my hospital, in every single OB operating room, I have a video laryngoscope mounted on the IV pole. I don't have to find it. Whereas if you're in a low resource setting, you may not have that. And so maybe some of the things that we discussed in a little bit about management and mitigation of pain may actually be what they have to do. But I would say most of us are practicing in hospitals here in the U.S. that have the ability to safely secure the airway. There are some times, though, you know, where patients have a really difficult airway and we know about that. And you know, so there's things that maybe we can do before the C-section to prevent pain as well. Again, we'll discuss those.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about pain. So how common is intra-op pain during a C-section? You know, let's give people an idea of how common this is. And then also, you know, is some pain okay? How do we know when it's too much? How common is some pain versus bad, intolerable pain? And how can we tell, you know, or can we tell who will have, are there predictors that we can say, you know what, you're more likely to have pain during C-section or you're not? What do we know about pain?
Well, I think it's important to go back to 2016, when Susanna Stanford, a patient who experienced intraoperative pain, published her experience. So she published her personal experience with pain during cesarean delivery, and she, in this report that was published in the International Journal of Obstetric Anesthesia, describes how at the beginning of the C-section, she had difficulty distinguishing if her block was working. And then when she gave them permission to go forward, she immediately felt pain upon incision. She was given nitrous oxide, alfentanil, but this was not enough to treat what she describes as uncontrollable and indescribable pain. She finally requested a general anesthetic after the birth of her son. And then she goes on to discuss how she suffered from PTSD and really kind of almost lost the first year of her son's life, just doesn't remember a lot of that, and really had a lot of trauma and flashback events to that experience. And she is interviewed in the retrieval. So people don't necessarily have to read this. She does a nice job of describing what happened to this, but you know, through her brave account of this harrowing experience, I really think this is probably one of the first reported in a journal, you know, patient-reported experiences of pain. And I think that her bravery really brought this important issue to light in our specialty. I actually can still remember the first time I heard her recount her experience on an interview that she did with the OAA. And that was when I really feel like the first time I became aware of the patient perspective, as well as the long-term impact that this can have on our patients. And so I think that that is, you know, kind of one of the initial things that really got our subspecialty going on this.
Yeah. And that was such a one of the, I thought the most compelling parts of that series of the retrievals was hearing her talk about her experience and about how, not just how bad the pain was, but also how hard it was to feel empowered to talk about it. You know, that was really interesting, and I think a wake-up call.
Yeah, until I listened to the retrievals, I actually didn't know about that backstory, about how long it had taken for her to speak up. Because I just knew the Susanna that was speaking up, and so I didn't realize what she had gone through. And it is pretty, I mean, she's incredible. I've always thought she's incredible, but it was really cool to kind of hear a little bit more of her backstory.
Yeah.
So you asked about what's the incidence or how often intraoperative pain occurs. Yeah. And this is not an easy question that you ask, because there really are two distinct ways that inadequate neuraxial anesthesia can result in pain during cesarean delivery. And so when we look at our incidence rates, they really can vary anywhere from like 2% all the way up to 36%. So initially, early retrospective studies used data from medical records, and they relied on surrogate markers such as analgesia use, anxiolytic use, sedatives, repeat neuraxial procedures, or conversion to general anesthesia. And that's what they utilized to identify inadequate neuraxial anesthesia. Also, another common study that was used is this large systematic review of 54 randomized controlled trials that gave an incidence of 15% of patients needed to have supplemental analgesia or anesthesia in those cases. And so a lot of times you'll hear people say that there's an incidence of pain of about 15%, and that comes from that study. But more recently, fortunately, the studies are now focusing more on anesthetic interventions and are rather focusing on patient-reported pain. And so I think a lot of these studies were probably underestimating the true incidence of pain during cesarean delivery. So one study that was done by Keltz and colleagues looked specifically at the incidence, risk factors, and physician perception of pain. So they surveyed 193 patients in the recovery room after their C-section, and 12% of patients reported pain. Now, what is interesting in this study is that they also asked the anesthesiologist and the obstetrician about their perception of whether the patient had pain or not. And both groups of physicians underestimated the incidence of intraoperative pain with a false negative rate. So meaning the doctor assumed the patient didn't have pain and the patient actually had pain of 52% in the anesthesiologist group and 83% in the obstetrician group.
Wow.
So this study kind of gave us a patient-reported pain incidence, but then also let us know that we, as physicians, even the anesthesiologists on the side of the curtain with the patient, we oftentimes don't even realize that our patient is having pain. Another important study that was published last year by Sanchez and colleagues was a prospective observational study that approached patients after cesarean under neuraxial anesthesia to assess their experience with anesthesia care and management of pain. Again, they had a very similar incidence of 12% of women who reported pain during their C-section. But what is interesting about this study is that not all women who reported pain received some sort of analgesia medications. And not all women who received analgesia medications reported pain. So we have a mismatch or some sort of gap in intraoperative communication between the patient and the anesthesiologist. Now, the question is the patient not reporting pain because they were treated with analgesia? We the study isn't set up to determine that. But nevertheless, the inadequate management of intraoperative pain can lead to traumatic birth experiences. And so we definitely need to do a better job of, you know, better understanding this experience of pain during C-section. Predictors of pain. Mike and I performed a study with Emma Frank as the first author that evaluated predictors of intraoperative pain. And we gave patients a survey after their cesarean, inquiring about pain during their delivery. And we found an incidence of pain of 23%. And when we tried to determine different predictors, the only predictor that we really found was pain, predictor of pain, was the length of surgery. Now, if we look at other studies, a lot of other studies have also now looked at predictors of pain, and they find risk factors associated with pain are usually patient-related factors, so anxiety, substance use disorder, some anesthesia-specific factors, you know, use of an indwelling epidural labor catheter, care by a non-obstetric anesthesiologist, and then obstetric and surgical factors such as urgent cesarean delivery have all been associated with intraoperative pain.
Interesting. So let me ask you a couple things. Obviously, pain is a broad spectrum. And if you do these studies differentiate between, I mean, if you ask a patient, did you have any pain? And did you have any pain? And they say yes. You are then including both people who had some pain but were fine with it, right? It wasn't traumatic. It wasn't overwhelming. It was, you know, like a little pain. But you're also including people who had intolerable pain. So do these studies try to differentiate between pain that was intolerable versus pain that was completely tolerable? Because the other question is what is our goal? Is our goal to have zero pain, or is our goal to have zero intolerable pain?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We did, Emily and I, we did another study with Jessica Littman as the first author, and we surveyed 110 patients. And what we did is we used a new methodology to measure pain. Instead of asking patients an up-down, did you have pain, yes or no, we used a 100-millimeter VAS scale, and we said, mark your pain with an X. When one side of the scale was no pain and the other side of the scale was excruciating pain or the worst pain in their lives. And we defined a priori that 30 millimeters would constitute pain. And what we found was that 40 patients or 36% of patients met the criteria for pain during cesarean delivery. And what we found four things that were independently associated with pain during cesarean delivery. One was surgical duration. We weren't surprised by that, given that other studies have found this, including our own. History of anxiety was associated with pain. Interestingly enough, we did a validated catastrophizing questionnaire, and that was not associated with pain during cesarean delivery. As Emily was saying, activation of an indwelling labor epidural catheter, and this is versus spinal or combined spinal epidural, and the adjusted odds ratio for that was 6.13, so very high risk of having pain if you're having an epidural catheter activated. And we found that black race was also associated with pain during cesarean delivery at my hospital, with the white race as the reference race. And this finding was highlighted in the Retrievals podcast during the last episode. Now, to answer your question about severe pain, we did ask a separate question about pain during cesarean delivery as it was related to patient expectations. We asked them, was the pain worst, you know, was it no pain? Was it better than expected? Was it as expected? Was it a little worse than expected? Or was it a lot worse than expected? And what we found was that we found that 7 patients or 6% reported pain that was much more than expected. And another 7 patients reported pain that was more than expected during cesarean delivery. And so to answer your previous question, about 6% of patients are going to report, or at least in our study, 6% of patients reported severe pain, and another 6% of patients reported pain that was worse than expected, but not severe. And I think I'll let Emily talk about prevention and how we can prevent this kind of pain.
Yeah, I want to hear from you guys about that, Emily, about how we can prevent it. And that, I think, takes us to the question of adjuvant meds.
But I want to say something else about just the measure of which pain, because I think one of the problems that we have in OB anesthesia right now is we haven't agreed upon the best way to ask pain. And so every study that you look at is asking about it a little bit differently. And also within our practices, we're asking about it a little bit differently. So we heard on the retrievals how Heather Nixon's group has a pop-up in Epic where they're asking interoperatively. And I think, you know, that probably, you know, asking about it while the surgery is happening is probably the best way to assess this. Is the best way to ask, you know, on a 0 to 100, 0 to 10 scale, what your pain score is, or did you have pain yes or no? Should you ask it in the PACU? Should you ask it day one? When is the appropriate time? And currently right now, I think that number one, we don't have a validated outcome measure. And two, there's definitely not an agreed upon way to ask this. And so I think that really needs to be the next step, and that we need to get together and figure out what is the right way to ask this. So then we can, I think, do a better job of defining the problem. And that always helps. If you can define the problem, helps with answering the how to solve it.
Absolutely. Let me ask you guys this. Do you think, so it's been a while, but I think the way that we do anesthesia for vaginal deliveries is that we have a conversation with the patient, right? And we say, hey, do you want epidural? Do you want it now? Do you want it later? And the patient at some point will say, okay, you know, the pain is now at a point where I want the epidural, right? Do you imagine us getting to a point where that's how we do C-sections, where you try it under neuraxial, and at some point, if the patient says, you know, the pain is at a point now where I no longer want this, I want to go to general, just like a laboring patient who's having a vaginal delivery would at some point opt for the epidural, the C-section patient would at some point have the option to opt for general. Like, do you think is that where we're going? Does that make sense or not?
I hope that's where we're going. I think, and I think some of us are actually practicing that way now. So, I think this actually goes really well along with prevention, but we kind of keep trying to go take you there.
Yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
And so
meds. Yeah.
So I think prevention begins with our consent of the patient. So, Ruthie Landau and I recently wrote a review article, and in it, she established a framework for the informed consent process before cesarean delivery. So important points that we need to discuss is that no neuraxial anesthetic will make women feel nothing. We need to let them know that they're not going to go to the C-section and not feel anything if they're having this under neuraxial anesthesia. And so I have a spiel, and residents that work with me know I say the same thing every time. And I might even, maybe I said this on the ACRAC before, so I apologize if this is a repeat, but before a cesarean delivery, I typically tell a patient it is normal to feel pressure, pulling, tugging. You shouldn't feel anything sharp or cutting. There's a few times during your C-section, you're gonna feel a little bit more pull, a little bit more tug, and we'll try to warn you about those. And then what I have added more recently is then I say, now every once in a while, a patient's going to have more than just discomfort or pulling during surgery, and you're going to have pain. If that happens to you, I want you to speak up and I want you to tell me, because there are things that I can do to treat that. And then sometimes I'll point to their epidural. I can put medicine in your epidural. I can give you medicine IV, or we can give you numbing medicine down where the surgeons are working. But I prompt them, like, if you're having pain, tell me, because, you know, the studies are showing that anesthesiologists are bad at telling that. And then I say, and, you know, sometimes the pain, we can't treat your pain well enough. We have to go off to sleep with a general anesthetic. It's, you know, that's not what I'm planning for you today, but if we need to, we can do that. And I can do that safely for you. So I think it's important to have some sort of discussion with the patient about what to expect. And then also moving beyond that, we need to let the patient know that the anesthesiologist is going to check the quality of anesthesia, that the surgeon will check the quality of anesthesia before proceeding. And then, of course, as I kind of said in my usual spiel, if the patient's uncomfortable, to speak up, that we will acknowledge her pain, and then we will treat her pain.
Hey there, ACRACers. I want to tell you about a CME conference that I will be speaking at in the new year from February 28th to March 7th, 2026. It is an amazing conference. It is the Holiday Seminars Conference in Maui at the Hyatt Regency Maui Resort and Spa. I have been there before. I've spoken at this before, and it is incredible. The family, the Smith family that puts this on, they really do an incredible job. It's going to be some amazing speakers. It's a beautiful hotel and an opportunity to really enjoy Hawaii and Maui, and especially at a time when Maui is trying to recover from the wildfires. They're really going all out to try to make the tourist experience an amazing one. So I think this is a great year to come, and the conference is going to be incredible. You're going to hear from amazing speakers who are going to go over really, really high yield topics. I highly, highly recommend signing up for this. You can go to holidayseminars.com and click on the Maui link, and you can register there. You can use CME money. It is going to be amazing. So I hope I will get a chance to see you there. It'll be a ton of fun. And checking is a really important question. This came up in the retrievals of how do you test to see how adequate your block is. And they mentioned that they think maybe putting a clamp on the skin is maybe not adequate, or doing, I can't remember the other things that they did, maybe a some sort of wetness or something. But so how should we be checking to see if the block is working?
Yeah, I mean, if we go back to Susanna's story, part of it is that she really struggled to differentiate the difference between the cold fluid that they were spraying on her, and she couldn't tell if that she was just feeling wet or cold. And she describes a little bit that she was a little embarrassed that she had a hard time distinguishing that. So I think it's important that we give the patient adequate time without pressure to allow them to assess their level of block. Both the ASA statement on pain during cesarean delivery as well as the OAA statement recommend testing the block to light touch, and then also confirming the block with a straight leg raise and a clamp by the surgeon. But even all of those, as you allude to, may not be adequate. I think there's really no optimal method that has been determined for testing an intraaxial block that is going to predict 100% full, perfect surgical anesthesia. And, I think if we're going to be doing something sharp, then we need to be testing with sharp. So we in our hospital, we use, like a little plastic, vial, like one of those, I'm struggling with that, but the little introducers that we use to draw up meds, it's kind of a plastic sharp tip. I know some people use a broken tongue depressor. I've seen, all different things that are used, but you do need to have something that's a little pokey, a little sharp, if you are going to make sure that they're not going to feel the sharp knife of the incision for the cesarean.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, all right. So you said we start with consent. We talk about the fact that there is going to be some discomfort, some pressure, although the retrievals made the word pressure seem like it was a bad word and we should not be using it at all. And I think what I took from that is we can't allow providers to just say, listen, pressure is normal. That's probably just pressure. Yeah, I know it's okay. It's pressure, right? It's one thing to say you may have some pressure, but tell me if it's too much for you. It's another thing to just blame everything on pressure and not pay attention to the patient. So that's kind of what I took from that. But you said we got to make sure we're consenting correctly, explaining correctly what is going to happen and that we want them to speak up. We want to test well to see the best we can how well the block is working, and then what else can we do to prevent and then treat pain if it happens, to try to prevent GA? Again, not wanting GA to be a never event, but, what do we do between deciding there is some pain here and GA? What's the approach to try to mitigate the need for GA?
So, prevention is so important. And there's two different ways that we typically will provide anesthesia for cesarean delivery, and it's either with intrathecal medications or epidural medications. So starting with intrathecal medications, which is you know, typically what we're using for our scheduled C-sections, or Mike will talk a little bit more about his approach in a minute. But we think that the combined use of local anesthetics and opioids is really important for achieving that effective neuraxial anesthesia, as not, you know, having that, you know, we use fentanyl in our hospital. Some people use sufentanyl or alfentanyl in other places, but it really helps prevent those visceral sensations that patients often will describe as pulling or tugging, and has been shown to reduce pain during cesarean delivery. When we're talking about intrathecal bupivacaine, which is what most of us use, the ED95 for intrathecal bupivacaine administered along with intrathecal fentanyl and morphine has been determined to be 11.2 milligrams. And you'll see in the U.S., the ASA statement recommends 12 milligrams. And I think most hospitals use 12 milligrams or 1.6 mLs of 0.75% bupivacaine as the common dose. In our practice, we sometimes will increase our dose to 13.5 milligrams if we're concerned the surgery may be of longer duration. Or we'll add epinephrine to help with that additional duration, as you know, we've discussed that longer duration of surgery can definitely increase the problems with pain. So in addition to the intrathecal bupivacaine dose, utilizing intrathecal fentanyl is another important component, as I've already mentioned. But I wanted to discuss an important meta-analysis of 17 randomized controlled trials performed by Dr. Upal and colleagues, where he determined that fentanyl added to intrathecal bupivacaine reduced intraoperative analgesia supplementation by 82%. And so when I hear about hospitals that aren't utilizing intrathecal fentanyl for the cesarean deliveries, I just think that there's really no evidence to support the practice of not including it, and there really isn't any risk to the patient. It's shown to have a great safety. Mike and I performed a study together evaluating different doses of intrathecal fentanyl, and specifically compared 10 mics and 15 mics of intrathecal fentanyl, and found that there was a 33% reduction in needing rescue analgesia intervention with a 15 mic dose compared to 10 mics. So, you know, my typical spinal, you know, for a C-section is 1.6 mLs of 0.75% bupivacaine, 15 mics of fentanyl, and then 150 mics of intrathecal morphine, but that's more so for postoperative pain, of course, that is not going to help us as much for the topic at hand. Now, in patients with labor epidural analgesia, I think it's incredibly important to have active management of this catheter for successful conversion to surgical anesthesia. If an epidural is not providing adequate analgesia, it is not going to provide adequate surgical anesthesia. And multiple studies have demonstrated that the occurrence of breakthrough pain prior to C-section, as well as the need for physician-administered epidural top-up boluses, are correlated with the increased risk of pain during cesarean delivery and need for supplemental medications. If you have a patient that is complaining of a unilateral analgesia, there is evidence that pulling back that catheter 1 to 2 centimeters may potentially help your block go both, you know, bilateral. However, if analgesia remains insufficient, catheter replacement, again, should occur. Now, depending on whether the cesarean delivery is urgent or emergent, then we typically will give, you know, lidocaine 2% with epinephrine for our non-emergent, or chloroprocaine 3% with the addition of bicarb to expedite onset for both of those in our emergent C-sections. And just like for spinals, the addition of epidural fentanyl can improve the neuraxial blockade and help with the visceral sensations that the patients can experience.
And how much fentanyl do you give epidurally?
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey folks, if you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through an echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. The other day, I heard a murmur that my colleague with a regular stethoscope just couldn't hear. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis. Echo is backed by 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in my everyday practice with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently if you don't return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/ACCRAC. Hey, folks, between busy schedules and summer plans, if you're like me, you barely have a few free minutes and you want to be outside enjoying the weather, not stuck inside shopping and cooking. Factor solves that for you with their chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals that are ready in just 2 minutes, taking the hassle out of eating well. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and it really does. Even my 2 younger daughters, who are very picky eaters, are loving every meal we get from Factor. Some favorites are the chicken tikka masala and premium proteins like salmon and shrimp that come at no extra cost. And with 65 different meal options, you've got GLP-1 friendly meals packed with protein and healthy fats and savory global flavors like the new Asian-inspired meals influenced by China, Thailand, and more. Honestly, I'd still eat them for the convenience even if they weren't so delicious, but the amazing thing is that it's super fast and incredibly tasty. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Get started at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's code ACCRAC50OFF at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off plus free breakfast for an entire year. Hey, ACRACers. We are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME Smart Bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology Smart Bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex Smart Bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC. Hey, folks, I want to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs, made for awesome humans. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves her so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a med student starting out. Investing in a couple pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. All right, and we're back.
I give 100 mics, and I think most doses, studies will typically describe between 50 and 100.
Yeah. Okay, great. So you've laid out techniques to try to maximize the effectiveness of your intrathecal or epidural medications. Let's say that you do that, you think you're in good shape, you start, but now some point during the procedure, they're clearly having pain. So now what do we do? Obviously, the end point here is convert to GA, but what do we do to try to avoid that?
Yeah, I'm going to back up just a hair and discuss what we do in the instance of a patient who's got an indwelling labor epidural catheter. Just like Emily said, we should be actively managing these catheters and making sure they work correctly. And the question becomes, what do you do if you have a patient who has an indwelling labor epidural catheter that's not working and now they need a C-section? If you dose up that epidural catheter, it's got a high chance of either not working at all or not working well enough to provide a pleasant experience. And so I am a big believer that we should be removing these labor epidural catheters in the operating room and performing a new neuraxial anesthetic technique, preferably that encompasses a spinal anesthetic. And so if you look at three recent studies, one by Sanchez and colleagues that Emily talked about, the Littman and colleagues study that both Emily and I did together, and another study, a systematic review and meta-analysis by Charles and colleagues, all three of these studies showed an association between activation of an indwelling labor epidural catheter and inadequate analgesia during cesarean delivery. And Emily and I did a study where we did a propensity-matched retrospective review on patients who had activation versus removal of their labor epidural catheter. And what we did for the propensity matching is we did the indication for cesarean delivery, like why they're having the cesarean delivery. And we looked at how many physician-administered rescue boluses the patients received during labor, and that was a proxy or surrogate marker for how well the epidural catheter was working. And so we came up with 124 patients in each cohort. And what we found was that patients who had removal of a labor epidural catheter followed by a new neuraxial technique had an odds ratio of 4.3 of having a regional-only anesthetic, that meaning no additional anesthetic medications. And so this is pretty compelling evidence. My current practice is that I have a very, very low threshold to remove labor epidural catheters and put in low-dose combined spinal epidural anesthetics. This is not to constitute medical advice, but what my usual recipe is I will do 1.2 milliliters of 3/4% heavy bupivacaine, and I'll use the usual opioids at my hospital, which are 15 mics of fentanyl and 150 mics of morphine. And I like to do this in a combined spinal epidural technique because if the block is too low, the epidural catheter gives me an opportunity to move the block higher. And our practice is such that about 40-45% of our indwelling labor epidural catheters are removed and a new neuraxial technique is performed. Now, this technique is not without its drawbacks. In our cohort of 124 patients that had their catheters removed, three of them did not have completion of a new neuraxial technique. I think a lot of this had to do with urgency of the procedure, and they went to sleep anyway. And one patient of the 124 had to be intubated for what was a high spinal block with dyspnea. And so this technique isn't foolproof, but I think it's should be considered, particularly for patients who've got risk factors for inadequate analgesia during cesarean delivery.
So, Mike, that's great. Let me give you a scenario and tell me what you would do here. So you have a woman who's in labor. She has an epidural in place. Your resident gets called because she's having pain and goes and boluses the epidural with 10 mls of, you know, whatever it is that you're running, 8% bupivacaine. And then 30 seconds later, the OBs decide they have to do a C-section. And by the way, the bolus didn't help at all. So you know this is not a working epidural, but you also know they just got 10 mls in there. Do you do the spinal with the dose, the 1.2 mls, or do you do something different?
That's an amazingly good question. And so this varies from patient to patient. One of my considerations would be, or one of my things I would do would be to test the block level and to see what that 10 mls did for the patient. If the block level is low, like if it's T10 or lower, then I'm probably going to remove the epidural and do a low dose spinal. If the block level is high, like if it's up to T4 on any level, or any side of the patient, I'm going to be a lot more hesitant to do a spinal because I have fear of high neuraxial block. But every patient is different, and a lot of it has to do with how the patient's airway looks too. If this is a patient you could easily intubate, you might be a little bit more aggressive and removing that epidural and putting in a spinal or a combined spinal epidural. If the patient is difficult appearing, you want to manage that airway under your own terms and not be in a reaction to a high spinal block. And so, but I still have a strong preference and a low threshold to remove these enjoying labor epidural catheters and do low dose CSEs, particularly when the epidural is not working well for labor.
Emily, how about you?
Yeah, I think when you're managing this, you really have to consider the two different scenarios, right? Because you have some that you know the epidural just has been not very great for analgesia. And so you definitely manage that differently than someone you've already started bolusing. And I actually had a call not recently, it's been long enough that I've recovered, but I did have a call shift once, but I had two patients coming to the OR very similar times who had labor analgesia catheters that were not adequate. And so I pulled both of them, and one of them had unfortunately been bolused for a forceps delivery. And so she had already gotten a good amount of local anesthetic for that forceps, had a failed forceps, and now we had to move to C-section. Baby was doing fine, so we had time to do a combined spinal epidural. And I did a low-dose spinal, but I did actually end up with a high spinal with her. So I did not do a low enough, low dose. Whereas the other patient hadn't had any bolus of her epidural, but she was starting to have pain. And so we were able just to pull it, did a CSE for her, and things worked out well. So it's really I think you need to have a whole lot more caution when you're going to be pulling an epidural catheter if you've already started to bolus that epidural. That's I think when we really get in trouble is when you've already given 15 or 20 mLs of lidocaine or chloroprocaine and the epidural is not set up. And now you're like, oh no, now I need to do something else. And it could be really tricky. And, Mike's had a lot of great advice about considering, the patient and the airway and such of whether you're willing to take that risk of putting a block that could potentially go high. So,
yep. Great points. All right. So let's then get back to this question of we've done everything we can to optimize the neuraxial approach. It's not working. The patient's having pain. How do we handle that? And this scenario is we're in the middle of the C-section.
Well, you're not supposed to have already put me in the middle of the C-section. No, I think we've done a good job of talking about, if your patient's, if the catheter doesn't seem to be working beforehand, what we could do. And so if the patient is experiencing pain during the C-section, then I think what we need, the first thing that we need to do is ask the surgeon to pause. And if they're planning for, or if they've already done uterine exteriorization, or they're planning for that, you can ask them to close in situ, as studies have shown that there is less intraoperative pain, as well as less nausea and vomiting, both intraoperative and postoperatively in patients who have in situ repair of their uterus. And so a lot of times I'll work with my surgeons to be like, hey, could we close this this one in situ, and then reassure our patients. We need to tell the patient and also the support person that's with them that you understand that they're uncomfortable, and then ask if they would like medications. And if we're stopping surgery, we typically think that they're, that they would, but this all needs to be a shared decision-making process. Is the patient having pain, or are they having anxiety, and discuss, what's going on with them, and then we need to administer medication. So tell the patient what you're going to give them, and then assess the effect of the intervention, and then offer more if they need it. So good practice is to offer general anesthesia if this effective analgesia is not achieved. There's a lot of different adjuvant medications that we can give to treat this pain. And I don't know if Mike wants to kind of take over and discuss these.
Mike, you want to talk about your approach here?
Sure. So I was it was an honor for me to lead the working group on the recent ASA statement on adjuvant agents administered during cesarean delivery. And we talked about all the different kinds of adjuvant agents we can give, which includes medications given through the epidural catheter. Like you can give epidural fentanyl, like we talked about before. That's considered an adjuvant if it wasn't given already. Intravenous medication, I think that either intravenous fentanyl or intravenous dexmedetomidine is a great first-line agent. And there is a considerable difference amongst practitioners as to how to proceed after that. There are some practitioners who think that ketamine is a perfectly good anesthetic or analgesic medication that can be given. And it really does provide some good analgesia, but in awake patients without pre-administered anxiolytic agents, I think you run the risk of having some potential psychosis afterwards. I'm not a big fan of ketamine. Some other people are. I can't fault people for being enthusiasts of ketamine. But if my fentanyl and or dexmedetomidine are not working, I will consider inhaled nitrous oxide. I think that's a potent anesthetic. It doesn't have many psychotropic effects. And if fentanyl and inhaled nitrous oxide aren't working, depending on the circumstance, sometimes you'll get into a scenario where the surgeon just has to throw in one or two last fascial stitches. And I will occasionally give ketamine or propofol just to get that patient over that hump, knowing that the surgeon just needs literally 1 or 2 minutes to throw in a couple stitches. And if you think about it, if you were to do induction of anesthesia, you would give a lot higher doses for that would last a longer period of time. But I'm not a fan of giving perpetual serial big doses of ketamine propofol just because I don't want to bite the bullet and do a general anesthetic. And obviously we talked about before with shared decision-making, general anesthesia is sometimes the best decision for the patient.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Emily, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think each of us approach the medications that we give to patients differently. Because if you do look at the guidelines, a lot of times they will, you know, recommend nitrous and ketamine and those medications. And I agree with Mike, I'm not a ketamine fan, but I actually don't typically use nitrous either. And so my first approach after I've talked to the patient and told them the plan. If they do have an epidural catheter, I will administer additional local anesthetic through the catheter. And then for pain medication, I'll usually reach for IV fentanyl, and I often will combine that with IV dexmedetomidine. If pain continues, I've actually had some pretty great success with intraperitoneal chloroprocaine. It's not widely used, but has been recently studied specifically by Brandon Tagioka up in Portland. And basically before his study, I would always do 20 of chloroprocaine and 20 of saline and mix them together. But he did some studies to look at drug levels after administration of 40 mLs of chloroprocaine looked at patient drug levels and found that those were still within safe limits. And so since this study was published, I now will do 2 vials of 20 mLs of chloroprocaine. I dump it onto the kidney basin on the surgical field and tell the surgeons to dump it into the peritoneum and then tell them to not suction it up. And actually I'll have them kind of swish it around a little bit. And I've actually had some really great success. If the pain is happening later on and the patients, you know, have a spinal that's wearing off because the surgery went a little bit longer and they're literally closing skin, sometimes we'll just do local anesthesia right there on the skin, and that can work as well.
Yeah.
But if I can't get the patient comfortable with, with IV fentanyl, intraperitoneal chloroprocaine, then I'm talking to the patient. And again, I also said I really like IV dexmedetomidine. And so usually, you know, I'll start a little bit with the fentanyl, but then go a little bit more heavy-handed with my dexmedetomidine. But if I can't get the patient comfortable, then it's time to move on to the discussion of general anesthesia.
So let me ask you this. Let's say that you have a patient and they start the C-section, and after, you know, shortly after the start, they're saying, I'm having pain. And you say, okay, I'm going to give you, maybe you try some epidural or, you know, stuff, and that doesn't work. And then you say, okay, let me give you some IV fentanyl or IV dexmedetomidine. And they say, no, I don't do that. I don't want that. I'm worried about it getting to the baby. I just want to go to sleep. Are you going to is that okay? You say, okay, no problem. Let's just do GA. Or do you say, well, I'd really like to try these other medications first. You know, what's your algorithm there?
Well, a lot of times, I mean, I oftentimes am doing almost everything at once. I often don't do like a stepwise approach. But I mean, if at any point the patient's requesting general anesthesia, then I'll let them have it. I'm not going to deny that from them. And I do in my discussion when I'm talking with the patient, she's having pain, and say, okay, so my plan is I'm going to give you some medicine in the epidural. I'm going to give you some medicine IV. And, you know, these are the steps. We're going to do X, Y, Z. And if at any point, you know, you feel like this isn't working, then we'll go off to sleep. But I have to, you know, you do need to be careful with that, because you don't want the patient to feel like, oh, she can handle it, kind of like what Susanna described. And so, If I see the patient having pain, I say, this doesn't look like it's working, I think we need to go to sleep. But if at any point a patient requests it, I'm not going to deny them that.
And what if the patient, it gets into the subtleties of the consent process, but let's say the patient says, I want to go to sleep, but only, you know, only if it's not going to put me or the baby at risk, right? Do you say, I'm confident it won't? Do you say, well, look, there's always risk? You know, because again, this is like, if you say there's risk, then some number of people are gonna say, well, listen, I'd rather take the pain. I don't want to put my baby at risk. I'd rather take the pain. Others might feel differently. But so, you know, where is our responsibility in terms of being honest, but not discouraging of GA? This is where it gets really subtle.
It's very subtle and very tricky. And so I think this is where, I mean, and hopefully you're at a point in the surgery where you can have the surgeons pause, so you have a little bit of time for discussion. And that's when we have a discussion about the risks of general, because there's no such thing as no risks. And, you know, you can say, you know, your airway looks fine. I think it would be good, but pregnant women are increased risk for difficult intubation. But so that, you know, and if they're requesting general anesthesia prior to delivery, then 100% chance that, you know, the meds will cross over to baby as well. And so I definitely think it's important to talk to the patient about that. And then, like you said, then they maybe will be like, no, actually, at least let me decide. And I mean, I had a terrible case where a woman had a lot of pain during her C-section, and I recommended that she go off to sleep. And she was like, no, I don't want to go off to sleep. And so I, you know, did a couple other things, and the surgeon started again, and she was having a lot of pain. And I said, I feel really uncomfortable. I feel like we need to have you drift off to sleep. And the patient refused to go off to sleep with general anesthesia. And, you know, fortunately for that case, things were emergent. And so that's why everything was kind of happening quickly. And once her epidural actually set up, we were able to go. But the first few minutes of the case, the patient had a lot of pain and was screaming. And, you know, myself and the amazing CRNA I was working with really wanted to have her go to sleep, but the patient refused. And so I'm not going to assault her with my general anesthetic. And I had to abide by her desires. And you know, I, of course, did, you know, went and followed up with her afterwards about it, because I said, you had a lot of pain at the beginning of your C-section. Let's talk about it. But she ultimately actually was really pleased with how things went, because she was able to be awake, and that's what she wanted. And that's really, I think those are the hardest cases as anesthesiologists, because like our goal is to like take care of our patients and provide them a safe and comfortable experience. And when we aren't able to do that, and the patient has pain, yet they aren't listening to what our recommendations are. I mean, that's you know, patient autonomy is really hard sometimes.
Yep, totally. All right, so let's talk about the conversion to GA. Let's say it's the patient says, this is not tolerable. I want to go to sleep. We want to be open to that. How are we going to do it? Are there certain techniques? Do we go straight to the VL? Is that kind of standard of care these days or not? What medications are we using? Is it propofol sucks? Is it something else? How are we approaching it?
Yeah, so I think this is what strikes fear in the hearts of people and converting to general anesthesia is what do you do? How do you do it? And so one of the older studies from the mid to 2010s quoted a failed area risk for obstetric patients of about 1 in 500, and that figure has been updated with a more recent published in 2022 using MPOG data. And what they found was that the risk of failed intubation was now 1 in 800. And this includes the use of video laryngoscopy. And so I think that, as you said before, our tools for managing the airway are much different today than they were in the 80s. And so that being said, I think it's 2025. I think that every single obstetric operating room should have at least the availability of video laryngoscopy. And I think we're going towards using video laryngoscopy as the first line technique. And with the hyperangulated blade, like a D-blade on the CMAC system, for instance, you're obligated to look at the screen and not do direct laryngoscopy. It is possible to use a Macintosh-style video laryngoscopy blade, and the operator can still do direct laryngoscopy and then switch to video laryngoscopy if they so wish. My personal practice, and this may vary from others, is I will typically just use a hyperangulated blade because we've gotten so good at it, and it's the final common pathway. If everything else fails, we go to the hyperangulated blade. And so my thinking is just to go to the hyperangulated blade anyway. And I think that in these circumstances, you have to take, particularly in training institutions, you have to take a critical look at the patient and the trainee. It should be the most experienced operator who's doing this intubation. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the attending, but if I've got a CA1 who's only done less than 100 intubations, they're probably not going to do the proctorian airway for a C-section. It's probably going to be either a senior resident if they're available or just myself. And so I think we have to really kind of weigh the interests of the patient against our goals of training our residents. And for managing the airway, I think one thing to keep in mind, if you remember anything else from this talk, is that an LMA is permissible and acceptable for managing the airway, particularly when you are unable to intubate with video laryngoscopy or any other technique. And the OAA and the Difficult Airway Society guidelines state that you can use a laryngeal mask airway to not only rescue yourself from the failed airway, but to do the rest of the case, particularly when you have a fetus that's in trouble and you don't want to take extra time managing the airway. And I had a case like this once where I just couldn't intubate the patient. We put an LMA in, we got the baby out, and with my most nicest tone, I asked the OBs if they could just go as quickly as they could, and they did. And that case ended up really well. I've heard of anecdotal reports and seen case studies where anesthesiologists will perseverate on trying to secure the airway while the fetus is dying. And by the time they secure the airway, there's already been a bad neonatal outcome. Now, for the induction of anesthesia, we're typically using propofol and succinylcholine. The use of opioids is plus minus. If you give fentanyl, you have the chance of causing some neonatal depression. There was a study by White and colleagues that showed that compared to a placebo, fentanyl reduced 5-minute Apgar scores. Some other induction agents did not, like remifentanil, L-fentanyl did not. There are some people, myself included, who will use Esmolol and induction and use it for the effects of mitigating the sympathetic response to laryngoscopy. As far as what we do with volatile anesthetics, you want to limit the volatile anesthetics prior to delivery, but you also want to be able to deliver 100% FiO2 to the patient so that the fetus has a good oxygen, so the fetus is receiving enough oxygen. So if the patient's oxygen saturation is below 97%, I'm reluctant to give nitrous oxide prior to delivery. After delivery, we know that volatile anesthetics will decrease uterine tone and could increase blood loss. And so we will try to decrease volatile anesthetics by administering nitrous in place of some of the volatile. And one of our colleagues from across the pond advocates for TIVA, total intravenous anesthesia with propofol, that could provide a better profile for blood loss. And that's a great idea. The problem is implementing it in the middle of the night when you have a stat section. It's hard to do.
Great. Emily, anything to add?
Yeah, on that TIVA. I use a lot of this of similar medications, but we actually do a TIVA for every C-section that we do under general anesthesia. We typically don't start with a TIVA, just as you say, when it's emergent. You don't have time to set up the propofol infusion because this is all typically emergent. We don't have the time. And so we will start with volatile agents. But once we've gone through all of our required checklists of the things that we need to do and we're settling things in for the patient, the first elective thing that we do is we pull out our propofol infusion and move the patient to complete IV anesthetic, because I do think that it can help with that uterine tone profile. These are young, healthy women who have a high risk of post-op nausea and vomiting, and so that's going to help that as well. And so we do that. And we do have like remifentanil available in our pick and all of our OB anesthesia Pyxis machines, so that if the patient has specific, cardiac disease or poorly controlled hypertension with their preeclampsia, things like that, and they do feel like they need something more than just prop sucks tube, we do have remifentanil available to administer for those unique cases. But for the most part, we do as Mike talks about.
Great. All right. This has been fabulous. Anything that we didn't cover that you want to add before we move on, either of you?
Again, I think the take-home message here is the title of the talk, just put them to sleep. I think if a patient is experiencing inadequate analgesia and you've tried to treat it with adjunctive medication and the patient still wishes to go off to sleep, I think we need to just put them off to sleep.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the paradigm shift. And it's so important, right, is that practitioners have to feel supported in that decision. They can't feel like that's a violation of the standard of care. And that is how it is felt. I had no question when I was a resident, I felt like the message we were getting was avoid it at all costs. And so that's what has to change. And this is great that we're doing this, because this message is going to get out there, as well as the Mike, you giving talks, the retrievals, what Heather's doing, Emily, what you're doing. This is all going to eventually move that needle. So that's why this is fabulous. And I really appreciate you guys sharing the message. Let's move on to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Emily, what would you recommend the audience check out for fun?
Okay, so I just finished this book on Monday, and the author is Frederick Bachman, who is actually one of my favorite authors. So if you are familiar with either his Beartown series, A Man Called Uva, or Anxious People, then I think you'll really like this book. His most recent book is called My Friends. That was just translated into English this year. But it's a story of four teenagers and a powerful summer where they find connection. And then many years later, their story has an unexpected impact on another young stranger's life. But it is just typical Bachman writing with a lot of humor, and there's moments of tears and moments of joy, and I don't know, it was really fun, and I'd highly recommend recommend the book.
That's awesome. I just started it, so I'm excited to I'm excited to keep reading it. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mike, how about you?
Oh, I am far less cultured than the two of you. My recommendation is a little more lowbrow. I recommend you go see the newest Jurassic World movie. I've been a fan of the Jurassic World franchise since I was a high school student in the 90s. They made it a part of our science class to discuss DNA and the theoretical concepts of Jurassic Park. And the current Jurassic World, not to give too much away, but the premise is that these big dinosaurs did not have cardiovascular disease, and some drug company is interested in getting biosamples from these dinosaurs so that they can develop the next blockbuster cardiovascular drug. And that at this point in time, the dinosaurs have become kind of extinct again because the whole human race is sick of dealing with them. And there's one prohibited island that no one's supposed to visit, and they go visit it and try to get these samples. And I'll leave it at that. I don't want to spoil the movie, but it's a really fun movie. Obviously better to see at the movie theater if you can because of the sound and the effects, but I think it's still enjoyable if you can watch in your home.
Fabulous. I am going to recommend two things. My wife and I saw the new Superman movie and thought it was actually quite good. I grew up with the Christopher Reeve Supermans, and I don't think anything is as good as those. But despite that, it was pretty entertaining and I think worth seeing. And then a book called The Doorman by Chris Pavone, which is quite good. It's not super deep, but entertaining read set in New York City. The main character is a doorman in a very wealthy apartment building right on Central Park. And there's a lot of things that happen. I won't give away, but it's entertaining, easy read, nice summer read. So I recommend that. All right, Emily and Mike, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for giving us a platform to be able to talk about this important topic in anesthesia.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.